This week on The Score, Dave Bratt and Abigail Spanberger debate. A presidential scholar examines impeachment. State and local governments innovate technology rules. A historian looks back at the rise and fall of Joe McCarthy. All this and more coming up on The Score. Don't go away.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
Welcome back to The Score from Bering Drift. I'm your host, Rick Sincere. Election day is coming up fast, and candidates around the country are debating their opponents formally and informally. Last Monday, two of the three candidates running in Virginia's 7th Congressional District met on stage at Germanic Community College in Culpeper in what will probably be their only debate. Republican incumbent Dave Bratt sparred with Democratic challenger Abigail Spanberger. Libertarian candidate Joe Walton was excluded from the debate, but he was seen in the audience taking notes. After the 90-minute event, both major party candidates spoke separately backstage to the news media. First came Congressman Dave Bratt. Our recording begins with the press conference already in progress. Abigail Spanberger follows.
At every turn was the solution. In contrast with results that we've delivered on tax cuts, on immigration, on health care, and that's what happened in that room, and I think that's what the people of the 7th District want, and that's the most important piece, right? The people will decide on the representative, and I think they're in tune with that smaller federal government, right? In a nutshell, the overriding issue was, do you want more federal government in your life, or do you want less? And I think the 7th District and the country is starting to see, for the welfare of their kids and the future of economic growth, we want less government intrusion in your lives. And I'm happy to take a few questions.
Congressman, yes, for the past half century, Congress has been ceding authority to the executive branch. Do you think there's a way for Congress to reassert its Article I authority and reclaim it from the White House?
Yeah, absolutely. I reconvened and restarted the Constitution Caucus for that reason. My life has been spent as an educator. Taught, you know, the history of philosophy, economics, ethics, James Madison, the Constitution, and economics. And we've got to return government to the people. And that's what we're talking about, right? So Article 1 in the Constitution is Article 1 for a reason. It's us. We're the heartbeat. We're the people that get elected every 2 years. We are closest to the people. It's our job to legislate. The Senate has its role. It more from its original tack by representing the states, and it was more tightly moored to the people originally, and it's gone off a little bit from a true representation of the state legislatures. But you're right, we've ceded power to the executive and to the judiciary, and you just saw in D.C. The power that the judiciary holds. It's our job to make the laws. It's the court's job to interpret the laws, right? And the executive, of course, plays an important role, but they're not Article I.
Congressman, could you explain for our German viewers?
Oh, good. Hello, German.
Thank you.
Where am I looking?
Thank you for that. You try to paint your opponent as being a rather liberal, progressive, leftist, democratic candidate, even though she runs on a rather moderate program. Could you explain this phenomenon of the election campaign to 2018?
I differ with your characterization. And so JFK, who you Germans may know, Ich bin ein Berliner, I think, famous little phrase, right? He's a good liberal. He couldn't get elected in the modern Democrat Party, right? So what changed? JFK was committed to supply-side tax cuts. He was proud of his Catholic faith. He was for strong America, strong foreign policy. He couldn't get elected right now in the current Democrat Party. So I don't agree with the premise. If you see what's going on in this country, the Democrats now are not liberals in the classical sense, right? I'm a classical liberal. Adam Smith, James Madison, the Enlightenment figures that created our government, created free markets, were classical liberals. What you have on the left right now, they are not classical liberals, right? They are not devoted to the rule of law, classical Chicago-style economics that has produced growth all over the world. And so I don't agree with the premise. Appearances of moderation, rhetoric of moderation, but not practice of moderation. There's nothing moderate about bankrupting the country. There's nothing moderate about 40 years of wage stagnation. And that's just a statistic. And we have Republicans in there too, right? So that's not a partisan charge. 40 years of wage stagnation, right? That's not moderate. School systems that are failing right now is not moderate. And so we need major change. And I think that's what I tried to present in the room today.
Congressman Ratt, will there be another debate? I know Spamberger's staff said you backed out of it.
Yeah, no, we didn't back out. We're just working on the details. And so we're going to work on the details.
Congressman, Joe Walton, the Libertarian candidate, says that he was not allowed to participate in this debate because of your campaign. When you went up against Cantor in the primary, one of your criticisms was that he would not debate you. Is what he says true? And if so, how is this different?
I don't know the details on how the debate came into being, but I'll check. I do not think it was from my campaign. I'll check on that and get back with you.
Why do you think so many women are running for Congress this year?
Because they want to serve the country. And it's a great job. It's the highest calling. Wanting to serve your country is a great calling. And we need more of everyone running for office. And I wish more people would run.
Are you surprised by the strength of the pink wave and, I mean, of the strength of your opponent, female opponent?
Say again, what was the question?
Are you surprised by the strength of your female opponent who is new to politics?
You know, I'm surprised at the millions and millions of dollars that have come flooding into the district to support the liberal Nancy Pelosi agenda. That has been surprising. We have never seen outside money of that scale from Act Blue, with multi-million dollars, right, coming from Act Blue, by the way, in the press. Please do a little research and report on the news, right? Act Blue is the funder of the resistance movement nationwide, and that's the chief funding source for my opponent. And so if you guys report on some of the basic facts that are important for voters to know when they're casting their decision for their representative.
Okay, this is the last question.
All right,
can he ask a question? He's with the Deep Run Sentinel at Deep Run High School.
Of course, Deep Run gets a question.
So during the debate, when discussing school safety, you had mentioned that mental health is a key factor in protecting kids.
Yep, absolutely.
Does that also apply to the same, to just general gun violence? And if so, why did you vote in support of H.R. 1181, allowing mentally incompetent veterans to purchase guns, as well as HJ-40, which allowed persons deemed to be a danger to themselves and others to still buy guns.
Right. I don't think I'm going to have time to adjudicate all those, but I'll get you answers to all of it. The answer on the mental health question is yes, it applies to everyone. Right. It's a serious issue that is plaguing our society right now. The drugs, the trafficking, mental health, young people, suicide and depression is up 70% this year. Right. That is a catastrophe for this country. Last question. Who had it?
That was it.
Good. Thank you all very much. Great.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
Tonight was a great night. It was a fantastic experience to give the opportunity for so many voters across Central Virginia to recognize the differences that exist between my opponent and me. I was excited to have the opportunity to talk about the issues that are important to voters throughout Central Virginia and to talk about my plans and my ideas and what I think is so important to voters right here. It was disappointing to hear our incumbent, my opponent, continue to talk and misrepresent my positions, but I was very, very pleased to have the ability to talk about what it is that I'm working for and what it is I hope to achieve in service to the people of the 7th District. And I look forward to future opportunities to talk with voters. As many of you probably know, because we talk about it frequently, we have done over 135 meet and greets across the district and forums and events, and so I have enjoyed the opportunity to talk about issues with voters across the district. Look forward to continue doing so as well. I thank you all for being here tonight, and I look forward to answering any questions that you all may have.
The Republican candidate in California's 12th congressional district is Lisa Remmer. Do you suppose she mentions your name as often as Congressman Bratt mentions her opponent, Nancy Pelosi?
It's possible. It's possible. I think my opponent, Congressman Bratt, likely mentioned Nancy Pelosi's name more certainly than I mentioned his during the course of our event. But I think it's just representative of what we're seeing nationwide, which is so many people are trying to run against other Democrats because they don't have a record to run on and they can't necessarily differentiate themselves in a meaningful way from who their real opponents are. In this case, I am the real opponent.
You mentioned bipartisanship quite a bit tonight.
Yeah.
How do you propose that you work across the aisle when you're faced with the type of animosity you faced here tonight?
Yeah, well, so I think it's important. It's, you know, I'll go back to, I talked a little bit about optimism in my opening speech. I think it goes back to how it is that you look at challenges that are presented. And we have to work hard to try and find places of agreement. And we have to work hard and be committed to trying to find ways forward. You know, frankly, bipartisanship is what leads to long-lasting, truly impactful legislation, and it takes a lot of work to sit across the table from someone and discuss issues that are truly difficult and for some people truly emotional. But it is what it takes in order to actually make really long-lasting changes and to advance this country in a forward direction.
Too many people I talked to tonight mentioned or emphasized that it's important to them that you are a woman candidate. How do you yourself view that phenomenon that so many women are running for office this year? How do you see yourself as a congresswoman doing the job in a different way than a man? And do you feel as part of a woman movement, because so many women are running?
Well, nationwide across the United States, there are so many women candidates who are running, who are stepping forward, who have stepped forward to really try and make change within our government. I do see myself as part of that movement. It's amazing to be among so many phenomenal women candidates running nationwide. And the fact that I am a woman, the fact that I am a mother, the fact that I'm a daughter, the fact that I'm a former CIA officer, the former law enforcement officers, these are all aspects of the perspective that I bring to every challenge I face and every question I seek to answer. So I do think it is important to recognize that part of my life experience is the fact that I am a woman, and that is part of what I bring to my candidacy. But I think really what's most important is that there are so many incredible candidates, women and men, who are focused on really trying to make positive changes in their communities, focused on being really engaged with the voters across their districts, as I am here in Central Virginia, and focused on really trying to move this country forward by creating actual solutions and trying to solve real problems facing this country.
One name not mentioned a lot during the debate tonight was President Donald Trump. Are you hearing his name on the campaign trail very much as you talk to voters?
Not very much. That is a name that does not come up very regularly. People are talking about healthcare and education and job opportunities. People are talking about the challenges we are facing as a country, and certainly he plays a large role in some of those challenges, particularly when we talk about the tariffs as they came up in the course of this discussion. But overall, people are talking about issues that impact themselves and their lives. And those are issues like healthcare, like education, like jobs. And people are looking and discussing congressional candidates within the realm of what it is that those congressional candidates could really impact.
There was talk. Brad talked a lot about sort of the outside money being spent on this race, and I wonder if you think that's that should be changed at all somehow. You know, if you're in Congress.
Well, so Congressman Bratt, when he spoke about money, actually misrepresented a couple things. We just declared our financial disclosures for the third quarter of this calendar year. And in the third quarter, our campaign raised $3.6 million from individual donors. Those are individual donors, and the people are capped at $2,600. Notably, throughout the course of this campaign, we've raised $1.2 million from voters right here in the 7th Congressional District, and that is certainly a record for any
candidate running here in Central Virginia in the 7th District, including Eric Cantor, former majority leader. So I think that it's important to note that the support that I have and the support that's coming in favor of our candidacy is predominantly, is very strongly rooted here in the 7th District. That's where we originally built our campaign. I do support campaign finance reform. I do support getting, ensuring that voters continue to have a voice in politics, and that means that recognizing that voters, voters' interests are represented by the choices that their legislators are making. One of the things I made reference to multiple times is the tax cuts and the significant tax cuts that went to particular industries. And when you link those with the donations that individuals receive, individuals within Congress, it creates challenges. And so, as I mentioned, we've raised $3.6 million just in this past quarter, but I did that without accepting any corporate PAC donations, because one of the things that has been an issue that people frequently talk about within Central Virginia, within the 7th District, is that they are concerned that corporate PAC donations lead to and perhaps might have influence over the decisions that their legislators make. And whether that influence is real or perceived, to me, it doesn't actually matter. It's important that it breeds distrust on the part of the voters. And so that's something that I hope to change. That's why I've chosen not to take any corporate PAC money. And we've been able to build a strong campaign through the support of people across the district and beyond.
You run on a rather moderate program. Even your opponent tries to paint you otherwise.
Yes.
Some people see the Democratic Party at the crossroads, and they see that this moderate path, which has been tried so far, and they say, why don't we try a more leftist path to win again in this year and in 2020? What is your suggestion? Which path should the party take?
Well, the thing that I find really remarkable about the Democratic Party, and particularly what we're seeing within the Democratic Party this year, this cycle, is that the Democratic Party truly is a big tent party. There are people that really run a broad gamut of ideas and ideologies and priorities, and that is from very liberal, to more moderate. And I think it's important to note that this year we see candidates who really run the gamut, and they run the gamut because of the differences in the priorities that their districts have, the differences in their ideas of how to come at solutions. And frankly, when we're looking at how we can really find true long-term solutions to some of the challenges facing this country, it is through having that push and pull of ideas and the push and pull of discussions that we can come to some of the strongest solutions. And so I think I don't think it's a crossroads, I think it's a point of reflection where we realize and recognize and honor that there is such a broad base of support within the Democratic Party, and Democrats come in all sorts of forms, and it's through hearing that broad array of voices that we can really come up with the best policy.
Let me do one more question.
What do you think about the exclusion of Libertarian candidate Joe Walton from this debate?
It was, and I will look over to my campaign team to confirm that this is the case. Our campaign from the beginning said that we were willing, and that's right? Our campaign said, and it was my personal opinion as well, that we were accepting and happy to welcome Joe Walton on stage with us tonight. I believe that was a decision made on the on my opponent's side that he did not want him included.
Thank you all.
Did you miss a previous episode of The Score? Look for our podcast at BearingDrift.com.
Each month, the Charlottesville History Club meets to hear a lecture and discuss some matter of historical interest. This past week, historian Robert Toplin talked about the rise and fall of Senator Joe McCarthy in the 1950s. Afterward, I asked him to summarize his remarks for listeners to The Score.
He was very effective, at least in terms of exploiting fear, playing on the worries of the American people at this particular time. As I was saying tonight, the concerns were great about how the Russians were advancing after World War II and taking over Eastern Europe, and China had fallen to the communists, and the communists seemed to be making great gains, and then we were shocked to discover that there were spies in America who had given atomic secrets. All this was coming out shortly before McCarthy's mercurial rise to fame and power. So he played on all this and stirred up the concerns and suggested that he had evidence that no one else had about people in very high positions in the U.S. government being disloyal, dishonest, and perhaps even rooting for the other side in some respects.
And what's interesting about McCarthy is through his entire career in the U.S. Senate, he was the junior senator from Wisconsin. He never had the kind of seniority you would expect to be given the kind of chairmanship where he could hold hearings and such like this.
Yes, and many of the senators did not really like him. Some of them considered him reckless, quite a few, in fact. But for the Republican Party, at least, the leaders saw that he suddenly had a huge following, and his attacks could be very helpful during the election campaigns, 1950 and again in 1952. Also, they saw that when various senators rose up and criticized McCarthy, McCarthy went after them tenaciously, viciously, and ruined them. They lost elections. And as people began to see what happens to a politician who goes on the attack, they began to realize you're really looking for trouble. And so they were waiting for the time when he would become vulnerable, and it seemed forever. But finally, as we come to early 1954, he begins to slip, and he falls precipitously within a few months.
During your lecture, I asked the question, now that the Soviet archives have been opened up, we know that there actually were Soviet spies in the U.S. government, but McCarthy was unable to uncover any of them. Instead, he was placing blame on people who were totally innocent. Why was he so ineffective in the long run?
He was effective for his own purposes for a long time, you could say, and for those 4 years, he was arguably the most powerful politician in America, short of being a president, a Truman or an Eisenhower, but he was extremely influential, and people wanted to find him for speeches, and he was offered a lot of money to give talks all around the country during that time. So he was very effective, even though he didn't have the goods. He didn't have the evidence, as you say so beautifully, you're so correct, that he did not have real discoveries of truly dangerous people, but he kept talking the talk. And whenever people closed in on his claims and said, where's the evidence? We don't see the evidence here. He would point to somebody else. And he kept coming up with new names, and he kept going higher and higher. He began to sense that the bigger the person, the bigger the headlines, the more attention I will get, the more invitations to give speeches, the more money I will earn, and I will be powerful. And that's how he played the game.
At the same time that McCarthy was operating, there was the parallel investigations by the House Un-American Activities Committee in the House of Representatives. Representatives HUAC, and he seemed to overshadow them and perhaps discredited their own investigations, which were probably more effective.
Well, they discovered some problems. Of course, HUAC discovered the Hollywood 10, and they had to leave their jobs. And HUAC was, and Richard Nixon was involved with some of this, and he was discovering Alger Hiss, who was a prominent figure and leading intellect and all that, and turned out to be disloyal in some respects, gave evidence to the Soviets. So all these things were coming out of HUAC. Yet McCarthy got the headlines. He really stole the headlines. And I'm sure some of the members of the House Un-American Activities Committee looked with jealous envy at
or
the way.
Or disdain.
Or disdain, too, that they were losing the limelight to this character who was coming out of nowhere, it seemed. Not a respected leading senator, but suddenly he was leading.
And Joe McCarthy was a mentor to Roy Cohn, who in turn was a mentor to Donald Trump. Will you draw a direct line from McCarthy to Trump?
Well, I'll let people draw their own lines if they wish, but the fact is, yes, that people often imagine that McCarthy learned from Roy Cohn, but it's not that way, really. It's the opposite, because Roy Cohn came in later when McCarthy already was on the rampage, and he brought in this bright, talented fellow. And then Roy Cohn learned a lot from McCarthy and passed it on, not just to a current leader in this country, but to other people too. The idea was that you countersue, you attack when you're attacked, you never admit you're wrong, you always try to go after anyone who gives trouble to you, and sooner or later they're fearful, they're frightened, they're afraid to attack you or criticize you because they realize that they'll be in a terrible brawl. And it was Eisenhower, the president, who saw all this at first when he became president, and he said, I'm not going to get in the gutter with that man. I'm not going to drag the presidency in the gutter with that man. I will be silent, but I'll be waiting for the opportunity to do something when the time comes.
Finally, just tell me about the History Club. What's the purpose of this organization? How often does it meet, and what can we expect in the future?
Yes, our goal is to reach out to the public. People, I often meet so many people who are from all walks of life, but they're fascinated. They're curious about history. They read history books. They see movies about history. They're eager to talk about it. So our goal was to have presentations that are hard-hitting, that take a stand, that offer an interpretation, provocative, and then bring the audience in and try to make it sort of 50-50 presentation. presentation and audience discussion. And we'll not just have presentations. We have professors from the history department, the politics department in the months ahead once a month, but also we'll sometimes have a movie that comes out about some aspect of history. Well, let's bring a group together and talk about it. Everybody see the film, and then I've had this before in some programs, and folks love it. So that's the whole idea, to reach out to the public and say, you like history? Let's engage with history.
When the score returns, we'll hear from the Cato Institute's Gene Healy, who recently wrote a white paper on impeachment. We'll also talk to Jennifer Huddleston Spees of the Mercatus Center about technology regulation by state and local governments. And Patrick Huff of Young Voices will examine red governors in blue states. The score will be right back. Stay tuned.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com. The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit beringdrift.com.
Welcome back to The Score from Bering Drift. I'm Rick Sincere, and let's get back to this week's interviews. Gene Healy is a vice president at the Cato Institute in Washington. He recently wrote a white paper called Indispensable Remedy, The Broad Scope of the Constitution's Impeachment Power. I spoke to him recently in the Cato Institute's library.
Impeachment was in the Constitution, but out of 44 presidents, only two have been impeached, and one almost was impeached if he hadn't resigned. Why do you suppose that function has not been used by Congress as much as it might have been?
Yeah, I think it's something that the framers would have found quite surprising. And, of course, they're partly to blame. One reason it hasn't been used as much as it might have been is that the bar to conviction in the Senate, you know, two-thirds of senators present, is especially high, and there's not a lot of evidence that they understood how rare that would make presidential impeachments. The change to a two-thirds requirement comes late in the Constitutional Convention, gets very little debate. They're probably tired. But all the evidence is they, while few, if any, of the framers looked forward to frequent presidential impeachments, all the evidence is that they didn't view the prospect with the sort of trepidation that we do today.
We're talking with Gene Healy, who's a vice president at the Cato Institute. He recently wrote a study called Indispensable Remedy, The Broad Scope of the Constitution's Impeachment Power. Presidents have not been impeached, but other federal officials have, including Supreme Court justices. But even that was a long, long time ago. Why do you suppose the impeachment power hasn't been used for some of those lesser offices?
Well, there's only been one cabinet officer impeached. That was the Gilded Age Secretary of War, William Belknap. I think the reason for infrequent impeachments of cabinet officers and other executive officers is pretty clear. It's when there's enough pressure, when it rises to the level of where there's enough pressure on the president because of the actions of a subordinate official. Usually the president will, you know, they're political animals, they'll toss that person over the side. Judges have been the most frequent. The one Supreme Court justice, most of the rest of the 19 impeachments historically voted by the House have been federal judges. So that's not, which is odd because the bulk of the discussion at the Constitutional Convention is around the president, the impeachment of the president. And the framers envisioned a much broader application of the power. James Madison said that that impeachment, some method of impeachment, was indispensable for defending the community against the incapacity, negligence, or perfidy of the chief magistrate. The way things have evolved, we tend to collapse everything into the last of those three items, perfidy, bad behavior, abuse of power, criminality. But most of the evidence suggests that the founding generation viewed this as a more all-purpose remedy that wasn't simply limited to abuse of power or criminal activity.
To put a positive or optimistic spin on it, do you suppose that Congress over the past 200 years has just viewed the political process, the normal political process, as a better way to deal with malfeasance in office?
Yeah, that would be a very positive spin on it. I think the number of unchecked and abusive presidents that we've had would suggest that the political process isn't an all-purpose solution. On the other hand, impeachment is an unwieldy sort of remedy. For all the defects of a Westminster parliamentary system, one advantage it has over our separation of powers is that you can get rid of a malfunctioning or misbehaving chief executive over a weekend at a party conference or, if necessary, by a vote of no confidence. So in those systems, it's much easier to remove a misbehaving head of government than it is in ours.
Let's get to the meat of the matter, which is, what is the definition of high crimes and misdemeanors, and how can it be interpreted in the 21st century?
It's a term that, depending on which scholar you follow, it's a term that might have made its first appearance 4 centuries before the Constitutional Convention in English practice, and the language doesn't really translate very well into contemporary usage. So in one sense, it's very understandable why people think impeachment is a criminal process. This archaic term of art, high crimes and misdemeanors, certainly suggests that. But it's puzzling, right? It sounds like if you wanted to translate it into modern language, it sounds like grave felonies, but also lesser criminal offenses as well, which doesn't make much sense. In reality, high crimes were not just serious abuses. They were high by virtue of the person that was charged, men in high places. It developed in British practice as a way of reaching ministers of the king who were otherwise, not amenable to ordinary criminal process. Misdemeanors does not have the, or did not have the connotation of criminal offenses that it's taken on in modern parlance. Misdemeanors meant misbehavior. So you had, the framers were well aware that that phrase was not limited to criminal offenses. For one thing, if the framers had limited impeachable offenses to violations of criminal statutes, it would have been worthless right out of the gate, since there were very few federal criminal offenses on the books in the early years of the Republic, and per the original understanding, very little authority for most for broad federal criminal legislation. So the way to understand high crimes and misdemeanors is there have been a number of scholars who have tried their hand at a modern translation. One of them is Northwestern's John McGinnis, who I'm paraphrasing here, but it's serious offenses that call into question an official's fitness to serve as measured by the risks, both practical and symbolic, to the Republic by continued service.
One interpretation of high crimes and misdemeanors that I've seen is that it's sort of a general abuse of power. How do you distinguish between an abuse of power that is not also a violation of criminal law? How can the president abuse power, or any other government official abuse power, without breaking the law?
Sure. I think that's, the first example that comes to mind is one that the framers specifically discussed. It's use of the pardon power. The president's power to pardon is one of the most sweeping powers the Constitution grants him. And so unless you believe that Donald Trump could be prosecuted for obstruction of justice for wielding the pardon power to, say, pardon Paul Manafort or Donald Trump Jr. or anyone else. It's not a violation of the criminal law to exercise this power. On the other hand, the framers, including James Madison and George Mason, specifically discussed impeachment as a check on broad abuses of the pardon power. So there's a famous exchange between Madison and Mason at the Virginia Ratifying Convention where Mason says, look, we've given the president this broad power to pardon. What if he pardons crimes that he advised himself? And Madison says, well, if he does that, he can be impeached for shielding suspicious persons. So that would be one example of something that is not criminal, but is an abuse of power and is impeachable.
It's interesting that James Madison and George Mason could look 200 years into the future and see what we would be talking about in 2018.
Yeah, they weren't that prescient on everything. The most prescient statement about impeachment, I think, was made by Hamilton in the Federalist Papers, where he says that impeachments would seldom fail to agitate the passions of the whole community and divide it into parties. And that's clearly what happens. Not when we're talking about impeaching a judge. People don't really notice that unless it's Brett Kavanaugh. But when you're talking about impeaching a president, that you really do enter a fog of partisan and tribal warfare.
Is it possible in modern American politics to have an impeachment proceeding that is truly bipartisan, or is it always going to be Republicans against a Democratic president, Democrats against a Republican president?
Impeachments, particularly presidential, well, to back up, judicial impeachments have on many occasions, if not most occasions, been quite bipartisan. The five most recent judicial impeachments from about the mid-80s on all were overwhelming votes by both the House and the Senate. So those tend to, in recent years, have tended not to be partisan affairs. Presidential impeachments, I think, are always going to be partisan. But there's so you're not going to see an even split among parties as to a potential impeachment of the president. But there's partisan and then there's partisan. So most of the, for example, in the Nixon near impeachment, most of the Republicans on the House Judiciary Committee voted against impeaching Nixon. Some of them later said that they would have, had they known what they knew now, they would have changed their votes. But you're always going to have it's going to be a one-party operation. But given the, in order to be successful, given that we rarely have a situation where two-thirds of one party controls the Senate, it does have to, in some sense, be more than just a partisan operation.
Well, that's about all the time we've got. So, Gene Healy, thank you for talking about impeachment today. It might come up again in the next year or so. We'll see what happens after the election in November. But I appreciate you taking the time to be with us on The Score from Bering Drift.
Thanks for having me on.
Jennifer Huddleston Spees is a research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, where she focuses on the intersection of emerging technology and law. I spoke to her by telephone this week about a three-part series she has written for The Bridge on state and local regulatory innovation.
Tell me about the scooter wars. I noticed that you wrote something about that, and this has been an issue in a couple of places in our listening area. So what are the scooter wars?
We're on the verge of a new transportation renaissance, and the electric scooters that you may have seen popping up everywhere are just one element of that. While there have been a lot of different points of view on whether these are good or bad, and we've seen a lot of different reactions from cities either embracing the scooters or trying to flat out ban them, what's really important in all of this is that we're sending a message to innovators and entrepreneurs about whether or not transportation is an area that they can innovate in or an area where the status quo is going to continue to control.
Yeah, we're talking with Jennifer Huddleston Spees at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, And you've written a couple of articles recently about state and local innovation. And I was wondering if you could kind of summarize your thoughts on that issue.
Sure. A lot of times when we think about tech policy, we think about what's going on in Congress or what is the Department of Transportation saying about driverless cars. While, of course, the federal government plays an important role in technology policy, we've seen because of the pacing problem where technology moves faster than the government can, that in a lot of cases, states and even local city governments have stepped in to kind of fill the gap and signal the innovators that new technology is welcome here.
And give me some examples. I read in one of your articles about how Arizona has been a real hotbed of innovation.
Certainly. Arizona has really opened itself up and signaled that it really wants to be the new place for innovators to come. This is seen a lot in their way that they've really embraced autonomous vehicles. After California put their very restrictive regulations on autonomous vehicles, in fact, Arizona passed an executive order that legalized the testing of autonomous vehicles in their state. And as a matter of fact, one autonomous vehicle manufacturer put all their autonomous vehicles on a truck and drove them from California to Arizona because they were much more open to testing them there. As a result, starting this fall, people in Arizona in certain areas will be able to have a driverless rideshare, like an Uber or a Lyft, operated by Waymo, that will be able to come and pick them up.
Well, that's really interesting. Now, we've talked about scooters. We've talked about autonomous vehicles. What other areas are state and local governments innovating in a way that the federal government may be too ham-handed or lead-footed to do that kind of policy innovation?
Well, certainly transportation is an area where we've seen a lot of growth from state and local governments, particularly in a good way, in encouraging competition for innovation. But another area that we've seen is fintech or financial technologies that are coming about a lot of times with the use of smartphones. Again, Arizona has been a leader in this by creating a kind of regulatory sandbox where they've told innovators that if you have a product you want to try and launch in this space in Arizona, you can come talk with us before launching it, and we can kind of develop a pilot program or a test program that will allow you to try it out and almost have a proof of concept here rather than automatically slapping down regulatory restrictions that were designed for brick-and-mortar banks hundreds of years ago.
Now, this could be a problem if a state like New York takes the lead because they control so much of the space with regard to financial law. Are there problems with some states being too heavy-handed in their regulation?
That's certainly something that we have to be concerned about. As you pointed out, there are states like New York and California that tend to take a more regulatory or precautionary approach to technology. On the other hand, we've had a lot of states really step up and have a very good and innovative approach. As a result, it's certainly a balancing act where we have to think of the trade-off. We also have to think about whether those trade-offs of somewhat of a patchwork at times in certain technologies is better or worse than the risk of having a bad federal law and not allowing any of the good state law.
There's another concept that you hit on in one of your articles that I read, and that's soft law. What does that mean?
In some ways, it's easiest to define soft law by defining what it's not. And what it's not is what we would call hard law, which is very formal legislation. Not just in the term of legislation coming from Congress or a state legislature, but also in the form of rules or regulations that might be implemented by a local DMV or the Department of Transportation or Labor somewhere. With soft law, what it is it's guidance or recommendations or even some of these sandboxing experiments like I mentioned with the financial technology in Arizona, where instead of saying, we know what's best as the regulators and this is the way this technology needs to progress and you need to fall in line with these rules, you're given some sort of guardrail, so to speak, that provide a certain degree of certainty that allow innovators to know that their technology is not going to be rendered outlawed overnight, but at the same time is much more flexible and can change if we find that the technology is evolving a different way than we had thought.
It seems that we're in a very fast-paced environment, and how can regulators and especially legislators keep up with the changes in technology that are affecting our daily lives?
This is where regulatory humility is so important. In many cases, it's going to be improbable, if not impossible, for true top-down regulation to keep up with technology. So instead, what regulators probably should do is consider how are existing technologies, how are existing regulations impeding technology and innovation? What can be done to make sure that we don't have an outdated rule from the DMV that says that you must have a driver in the car and therefore aren't going to be able to do driverless cars? What about different regulations that may prevent someone from launching their own app or an online business because of occupational licensure rules in a state? So one of the things to do is really to look at existing regulations and examine what, if anything, needs to be done so that they aren't getting in the way of these technological innovations.
That's a good way of looking at it. I really like your phrase, regulatory humility. I think that's something that should be written in stone above every state regulator's office building. Do you have any final thoughts for us or ideas of where we can go for more information?
Well, I have a series of posts on Mercatus's blog, Bridge, that kind of talk about the good, the bad, and the ugly of when and local governments get involved in technology policy. And I think the important thing to know is that this is a shared space, so to speak. There's an important role for states to play, particularly in showing that different regulatory approaches may be successful for different technologies. And at the same time, though, we also have to make sure that we don't have any of those outsized problems from certain states or from a patchwork of regulations that prevent technological innovation either.
Well, thank you for your time today. We'll be linking to your articles on BearingDrift.com, and I hope we have a chance to talk again sometime about new innovations that are taking place.
Thank you so much for having me today, Rick.
Two of the most popular Republican governors preside over strongly Democratic states, Maryland and Massachusetts. Patrick Hoff, a contributor to Young Voices, recently explored the popularity of Larry Hogan and Charlie Baker in an article for the Washington Examiner. He and I talked by telephone on Thursday.
Larry Hogan in Maryland and Charlie Baker in Massachusetts are among the most popular governors in the country and certainly among the most popular Republican governors, yet they preside over very Democratic states. How do you explain that?
Well, there's a lot of different factors that go into their popularity. Obviously, their moderate approaches to politics has been attractive to not just moderates, but Democrats. And they're also very popular within their own party. So, what I argue in my article in the Washington Examiner is their emphasis on bipartisanship and their emphasis on pro-business policies really resonates with people in a time of such political partisanship.
It's an interesting approach. We're talking with Patrick Hoff of Young Voices and also The Lone Conservative. You recently had an article in the Washington Examiner which looked at these two governors. And one thing to note is that Larry Hogan looks like he's en route to becoming the first Republican governor reelected in Maryland since 1955. That's more than 60 years ago. Is it something that is more attributable to his temperament or to his policy positions that make him so popular in the heavily Democratic state of Maryland?
I think it's definitely a combination of both. You can make an argument either way. In a time where, you know, Donald Trump is the face of the Republican Party, it's certainly refreshing to have a Larry Hogan who's, yeah, as you say, he has this sort of temperament that really resonates with people of all political affiliations. But no, his moderate approach to politics in terms of policy is definitely part of it. You know, he's definitely moderate and even some would say lean more left on social issues. But business-wise and fiscally, he is conservative and it's clear. And he's been a huge advocate of cutting taxes, hasn't been able to cut as many taxes as he'd like to because Maryland is such a Democrat-run state. But he has been able to implement fiscally conservative policies.
Let's turn to Massachusetts, which over the years has had more Republican governors than Maryland has. Notably, Mitt Romney served as governor of Massachusetts. What makes Charlie Baker popular? What has he been doing to make it look like he's going to win re-election?
Well, he's even more popular than Hogan. He's actually the most popular governor in the nation. And I think a big part of that is it's very similar to Hogan in the sense that he has this temperament, and he has, even more so than Hogan, he's this likable figure. I mean, you see videos on the internet of him, you know, at bars drinking with locals. So he's created this sort of image that people really like. In fact, there's polls showing he's polling better among Democrats than his opponent, which is just remarkable. And I think the same goes, like, he's very liberal on social issues, but he's moderate and a little bit conservative on fiscal issues. And look, when you talk about the Republican Party, the most popular issue for conservatives has always been cutting taxes. Like, who doesn't want their taxes cut? So when you emphasize cutting taxes and even a little bit emphasis on cutting spending, people are going to agree, moderates and even Democrats.
What lessons do you think that Baker and Hogan have that could be taken up by Republican candidates or current elected officials in other states, especially states that have heavily Democratic electorates?
Well, a big lesson is that you do, in blue states, you're going to have to distance yourself from Trump. And that might be a hard pill to swallow for Trump supporters, but you can't side with the guy who's, you know, tweeting about porn stars, calling them horse face when you're in a state that's mostly run by Democrats. And Hogan and Baker have both been very critical of President Trump. And for very fair reasons. It's not that they're saying Trump's conservative policies are wrong, but it's mostly about his character. And when we live in such times that they're so partisan and so bitter, when they have this moderate, this focus on bipartisanship, this focus on, you know, being civil and working across the aisle, I think that really resonates with people.
Yeah, I think working across the aisle is something that both Democrats and Republicans are wary of these days. And yet, if you really want to get something done, you have to do that. You have to work with people of the other party. How do Hogan and Baker in particular overcome the tribalism that seems to characterize politics today?
Well, obviously part of that is politics at the state level are different than the national level. So it's not going to be as partisan, but it still is very partisan. You'll see on college campuses, just see it overall. When you think politics, now the first thing that comes to mind is Donald Trump. It's just national politics that are dominating headlines. But at the state level, you're able to work across the aisle without, because there's not as much spotlight on you. I mean, people aren't talking about Larry Hogan as much as they're talking about Donald Trump even here in Maryland. So they definitely benefit from just the more laid-back style of politics at the state level.
Yeah, I suppose in state houses, state legislatures, there's more of a sense of camaraderie because you're literally working with your neighbors, even if they are people from the opposite party.
Yes, that's very true. And in the case of Hogan and Baker, they really don't have a choice because state legislatures in Massachusetts and Maryland, although there's Republican governors, it leaves very heavily Democrat. So they don't really have a choice. It's the political reality that people have to face up to. And they've been able to do it in a manner that people seem to respect, obviously, as Hogan's point plus. And there's some polls showing Baker 30, even 40 points plus. It just blows your mind, really.
Do you think that given their success in states like Maryland and Massachusetts, that Hogan and Baker may have the opportunity for higher office, whether it's U.S. Senate or the presidency?
That definitely could be on the table for them. I mean, it looks like they're going to get 8 years in. But I think one thing to really keep an eye out for is if they do win, which it looks like they're going to, are they going to try to implement more conservative policies knowing there's not as much of a risk now that they don't have to worry about re-election if they get elected? So we'll see how moderate or how conservative they act in the second half of the term. And I think that would really show where they want to take their political career after their time is up.
Well, I guess that's the question that remains, and we'll be watching what happens in November. Thank you for your time today. Thank you for joining us on The Score from Bering Drift, and I wish you luck as you contribute to Young Voices.
Thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure.
That's all the time we have this week on The Score. For all the writers and editors at Bering Drift, I'm Rick Sincere. Be sure to listen again next week when we'll have more news, reviews, and interviews. And don't forget to tell your friends where to find us so they can join the conversation. Your ideas are always welcome.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com. The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit beringdrift.com.